Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Debtline Municipals. Today's podcast title is From Server Racks to Sales Tax, How ABS Stress Reaches Municipal Revenues. I'm joined by my Debtline Muni colleague, Kunal Kamal. Kunal, always good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Paul, and welcome, Laura.
And joining us for the first time is Laura L. Mayfield, Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager on Fort Washington Investment Advisors Securitized Products Desk. Laura brings nearly two decades of experience in structured credit and fixed income investing. Laura, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be here.
We wanted to bring you on because in the muni world, we're always watching different things that are happening in the broader economy. And one area we've been watching a lot over the last couple of months is asset-backed securities and in particular, securitization, different securitization products. So I want to start out with this question. Do securitized sectors move ahead of broader credit indicators? And can they be treated as reliable early signals of shifts in the underlying economy? And a follow-up question would be, which consumer ABS sector do you consider the most reliable leading indicator for broader credit cycles?
Yeah, it's a great question. Securitization does provide a lot of important data points, but it's also important to take that in context. Securitization only represents a portion of the debt out there that is raised in the capital markets. For example, the Structured Finance Association estimates that about 7% of all credit card debt is funded in securitization, and 16% of automobile debt, and then 40% of multifamily, and 73% of residential mortgage debt. So it is meaningful, but it's important to understand that it's not the full picture of the consumer credit landscape. That said, the securitization market does provide monthly or quarterly reports on the collateral performance of each of those securitization trusts. So that can give you a glimpse of how some of that collateral is performing, in some cases sooner than we get data on the broader macro level. So in terms of which sector I think is maybe most meaningful for as a gauge of overall economic health, I would look first to the credit card space. I think that gives you an early glimpse of stress on the consumer because consumers have flexibility around how they use credit cards. Think of it as an extra cushion of income for those that maybe need a little bit more flexibility from month to month as unexpected expenses and financial stresses come and go. You also have flexibility to pay more or less of what you owe from month to month. So one interesting data point that we track, the Philadelphia Fed reports the percentage of credit card accounts that are making the minimum payment or the full payment on a month-to-month basis. And we've been watching that since the beginning of 2021. The percentage of accounts making the minimum payment has trended slightly upward. So again, a little bit of an indicator of stress potentially on the consumer. Also, interestingly, the percentage of accounts that are making the full payment, so paying off their full balance every month, that percentage has also been trending upward over the past few quarters. So I think that feeds into that trend we keep hearing about of the K-shaped economy and the bifurcated consumer. You know, there's some interesting points that you can pull out of some of that credit card data.
Okay, Laura. So when you look at ABS performance across segments, not just credit cards, also subprime auto, which has been talked a lot about, student loans, what is your takeaway? Also, do you see any regional patterns emerging in this?
So when we look at the ABS performance across segments, again, bifurcation is really the underlying theme across everything. It's less about regional patterns per se and more about socioeconomic distribution. Just about any way you slice it, there are two different cohorts of consumer. That K-shaped economy, you have the strong cohort of consumer trending upward. Those tend to be slightly older versus younger. They tend to be the higher income quintiles. They tend to be those consumers that have benefited from higher interest rates because they have more exposure to financial markets. They've accumulated a disproportionate share of the wealth in the United States. They tend to have a lower unemployment rate. And they also tend to be those that are supporting a disproportionate share of the aggregate consumer spending. If you look at the consumer spending is roughly 70% of GDP in the U.S., and the top quintile of income earners represent 40% of that spending. It's becoming increasingly concentrated. And then on the flip side of that, you have the lower income cohort of the consumer, the other side of the K-shaped economy, those that tend to be the lower income quintiles. They tend to be those that are paying or feeling pressure from the higher interest rate environment. They aren't likely to have exposure in terms of an invested portfolio benefiting from financial market growth. They tend to have very little or no wealth accumulation. They tend to be younger, and which corresponds with a higher unemployment rate, less likely to be homeowners, so more exposed to rent increases rather than benefiting from very low mortgage rates that were locked in the lower interest rate environment. So a lot of pressure mounting on that lower half of the K-shaped economy. And we're seeing that play out in the ABS performance as well. And I think there are two different ways to slice the data. It's important to look at the macro data of all consumers where we see that K-shaped economy playing out. But at the securitization level, what matters from an individual bond perspective is, are default rates and delinquencies performing how the originator underwrote them to? So it's less about the macro trends, although those are important, and it's more a microcosm of one particular pool of loans that were underwritten and priced for a certain default expectation, and then how does that vintage of loan origination perform over subsequent years relative to how the originator underwrote it. So we're looking closely, having a lot of dialogue with individual originators and management teams to understand what are their expectations for default and delinquency performance as they originate new collateral, because we want to be able to monitor that over time and understand for each individual securitization, is that collateral underperforming versus expectation? Is it meeting expectation? Is it doing better than expectation? And so forth. So there are really two levels. I think at the macro level, we are seeing that pressure building on the lower part of the consumer base. But at a very micro level, we're also seeing a lot of issuers perform well in terms of what they expected to originate and how that collateral is actually playing out.
So Laura, we're recording on December 15th of 2025. So we literally have 2 weeks left in the year. And looking ahead to 2026, what are you watching most closely that could shape the securitized market and by extension, municipal revenues?
So we're watching a lot of different factors play out. To boil it down, I think number one is the labor market. We're already seeing some signs of weakness in labor, which bears monitoring going forward. We're keeping a close eye on job cuts and job openings. We know that new job creation has been very concentrated in healthcare and education recently, so that's a pretty thin base of support there. We do expect that weakness will probably continue through the first half of 2026 or so, but toward the back half of next year, I think some of the benefits, the fundamental economic benefits, the big, beautiful bill tailwinds will kick in from tax cuts and depreciation benefits and so forth, which should provide some support on the labor front. But not just the labor market bears watching. We're also looking closely at consumer data again. So consumer sentiment has been struggling a bit, which that is soft data, but it can also be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If consumers are worried, they're likely to pull back on spending, which quickly converts that soft data into hard data. There's a Bloomberg series that looks at trailing 28-day year-over-year spending patterns, measuring transaction volume. So it looks at credit card and debit card transactions. And that series recently ticked down into negative territory, the biggest drivers of that negative dip being building materials and gardening care. So think about small home and yard projects, and also food and beverage. So people starting to be more judicious about spending there. And also furniture and home furnishings being the three largest negative movers there. So I think that kind of paints a picture of what's weighing on the consumer and where they're starting to pull back around the edges. There's another data series we look at, consumer expectations of losing a job over the next 12 months. That series has spiked up for those with income under 50,000, which is a diverging trend from the other two cohorts that data series tracks, which is the 50 to 100,000 income and 100,000 plus income cohorts, which are still have diminishing expectation of job loss over the next 12 months. So again, a little bit of a concern there weighing, especially on the lower cohort of income earner there. But ultimately, I think to kind of roll all that up, we're looking at default rates on consumer debt. There are certain segments in the securitized space, especially where delinquency pipelines have ballooned a bit over the past few years, and that hasn't fully translated into default rates at the way that it historically typically does. So there's a little bit of potential energy there, I guess, to the downside. Consumers starting to feel stress and they're falling behind on a payment here or there, not fully defaulting on it, but maybe they don't have enough discretionary income to catch back up on that debt that's gotten behind schedule for them. So we are seeing some pockets of stress here and there, and that's all going to feed into what we're looking at over the coming year.
So Laura, there is another topic that has been, I feel like, grabbing a lot of attention, which is like data centers, even from locality standpoint and from the securitizations market point of view. In that space, what do you see as the most material risks and whether they are related to the underlying business model, power availability issues, or the rapid capital needs that are being driven by the AI infrastructure buildouts?
Yeah, I think number one is the monetization timeline. There is so much capital feeding into the build out and the infrastructure and the development of data centers to feed the demand for AI and exploratory use and trying to convert that to productivity gains. And I think the question right now is that capital expenditure cost justified? And what is the timing of that going to be? I think there very well could be some winners and losers in this as it plays out over the coming years. Steve Eisman on his podcast, he likens it to, or he compares some of the similarities to the railroad industry build out in the United States and how there are examples of railroads being developed by two different entities, in some cases side by side, in competition with one another. And there were winners and losers. Some of them were successful and some of them weren't on a sustainable basis. And I think we could have some of that here as well. There's a lot of money being put into this development right now with a lot of uncertainty. And it's not just about whether or not AI will be here to stay. I think that we all agree it will to some degree, but it's really about, are we spending the right amount of money to get there? And I think there may be some overspenders and there may be some appropriate spenders, but we don't yet know. It's still early days. You mentioned power availability. I actually see that. Yes, it's a problem that the sector is going to need to figure out, but in the near term, I think it's actually a governor on overbuilding because there is a limit to the availability of power and fiber infrastructure and all of that. And to some degree, I think that helps us because it puts a limit on how much overbuilding can be accomplished in the near term. And then I think a couple of other issues worth monitoring, the labor force implications of AI. There's a lot of chatter around concern about job loss in certain fields as entry-level jobs are replaced by AI and so forth. But I don't know that anyone can really model out what that's going to look like at a macro level. And I think that's something that's worth considering. Not that we should halt our progress, but I think we need to do it in a way that's rational and that with an eye toward the downside risks of what happens. This is not my expectation, but if we're developing a technology, for example, that could put 25% of the workforce out of work, I think we'd all agree that we need to be thoughtful about how we pursue that. So I think just a lot of uncertainty at this point. And regardless of those questions that nobody has answers to, we're still plowing full steam ahead into this space. So a lot of unknowns, which in our world are financial risks.
And as you said, a lot of people are actually going full on steam with this. And also seems that is private credit, which is becoming an increasingly important lender in this space. But from a securitization perspective, how does private credit's growing presence shape the risk profile for you guys? Or does it raise concerns about leverage, transparency, structure compared with more traditional financing channels?
So it's really interesting the degree to which data center CapEx and AI spending is leaning toward the private credit space, because on one hand, it makes sense from both parties' perspective. From an investor standpoint, if you are bullish on this sector and you want more exposure to it, it makes sense naturally to pursue that investment in the private space in addition to what's available in the public space. You can potentially get larger allocations and maybe more favorable pricing terms. Sometimes you can get bespoke structural features that are favorable for you and so forth. There are a lot of reasons why I can understand from the investor's perspective being providing financing in the private space. And from the debt raiser's perspective, that the companies that are raising capital in the private space, I think there are some clear benefits for them as well around transparency requirements, reporting requirements. So I think there are some privacy-related issues and concerns in this space, companies not necessarily wanting the public at large to know where their specific data centers are located and that sort of thing. But I think ultimately what it means for us, data centers and AI are something that affects the entire economy, whether we are allocated to that space or not. Concentration risk is something that you look at the equity markets. The S&P 500 is the Mag 7, NVIDIA, 7% of the entire S&P 500. You have concentration in GDP, with a significant portion of GDP growth coming from investment in data center and AI-related technology. So I think to the extent that we're getting less transparency around these deals and this expenditure because it's being funded privately rather than via public channels, I think the risk is that this sector, which impacts all of us, is less measurable by all of us. And there are fewer hands that have a better finger on the pulse of the health of the underlying transactions and the underlying monetization of those data centers as they are rolled out. So I do think there are some rational reasons why private credit makes sense for this space, but I also think we do need to have an eye towards some of the risks that poses.
So Laura, it's my last question, but it's a multi-part question because you've brought up a lot of interesting points here. So with data center securitizations, is that, when you look at 2026, is that at the top of your list, somewhere in the middle? Like, how important is it, what's going on in that particular sector?
I have a lot of different lists. It's at the top of certain lists and at the bottom of other lists. So full disclosure, we're not active on the ABS side in data center securitizations. We think there is a lack of transparency around, for example, we don't get disclosure around who the lessees are when we're presented a data center that maybe has an 85% occupancy rate, for example. We want to understand the granular terms of those leases. When do they mature? Who are they leased to? Specifically, what's the likelihood that those leases will be renewed or not renewed? We don't have enough transparency in the regular securitization market, from my perspective, to assess what the downside risk is in that space. Never mind the fact that all of the big picture uncertainties around technological obsolescence risk, overbuild risk, different competitive factors that could drive lease rates up or down going forward. So many questions that we can't come up with, I would say, like an educated downside risk, fundamental downside risk scenario for some of those assets. And if we can't quantify the downside risk, how can we say what the proper compensation or spread is for those securitizations? So in terms of where I'm looking to be most active, data center ABS is at the bottom. But as a participant in this market, data trends that I care about and that we're tracking, data center ABS is at the top, because we know that supply is going to continue to grow. I think in spite of demand being strong for this exposure, that growing supply is going to have to pressure spreads as we go forward. I think I get the sense that we are in the minority here in abstaining from that part of the ABS market so far. And I don't necessarily see what's going to change going forward to allow this market to absorb that increasing supply other than spreads widening out. So I think it's one of the more important sectors over the coming year to watch and monitor and understand. But in terms of our readiness to participate, we're not there yet.
So with the issuance pipeline is growing, there's questions around transparency, there's power consumption issues, there's a question whether or not the market can absorb the sheer volume of all these deals. From your vantage point, how significant are the disclosure and data quality challenges in this sector?
I think they're very significant. For us, that's one of the main reasons we haven't gotten comfortable to participate. Now, what I don't know is whether private transactions perhaps offer greater transparency. That's a possibility. But again, there are so many moving parts with AI development, incorporation of AI. Let me just give you an example. If a data center is leased out to a bunch of startups that are using AI in a more venture-oriented way, that's a completely different risk profile than a data center leased out to well-established businesses that have withstood numerous economic cycles that are incorporating AI on the margin to improve overall productivity. I think there are so many different ways that AI adoption will play out across the economy. And we're just at this epicenter of everybody is using ChatGPT to convert their family members into animals, for example. There's a lot of inefficient demand for the processing power right now. That's data center demand, even though we're not going to continue converting our family members. Like, we're not going to do that every day for the rest of our lives. There's this big inefficient exploratory phase that we're in right now. And I think eventually overall AI adoption probably is higher than it is, certainly will be higher than it is today. But I also think it could be a little bit of a rocky road to get there because there is inefficiency that comes with figuring out how to fully integrate it into your daily processes. And I think that once we get to a steady state of where it's incorporated and we're using it in a more sustainable way rather than just tinkering with it and exploring it, I think that will be a different picture in terms of our comfort level with having exposure to those types of deals.
Well, thank you, Laura and Kunal, for a riveting discussion on the ABS market and its connection to municipal finance. And to our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, commenting, and subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.